America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
Now to introduce our speaker and moderator and to give maximum time for our program and your questions, please welcome a key member of our leadership team, former member of the United States Congress, Mel Levine. Mel, it's your program.
Janice, thank you very, very much. Michael, welcome. It's a real pleasure to introduce Michael Oren to comment that the timing couldn't be more significant. Michael is one of those rare Israeli leaders, kind of in the pattern of Golda, who was born and raised in the United States and who became a prominent leading Israeli figure. I'm reminded that the first time I met Michael, we were in Jerusalem, and he was best known at that time for his highly acclaimed book on the Six-Day War. Some 17 or 18 years later, Michael is now known best in the United States for having served as Israel's ambassador to the United States from 2009 to 2013, while Barack Obama was president and Joe Biden was vice president. He found that experience so interesting and significant that he wrote another book, this time about his experiences, entitled Ally, My Journey Across the Israel-U.S. Divide. All in all, I think Michael has written some six books. His range of activities has been extraordinary. They include being a member of the Knesset, being deputy foreign minister of the prime minister, having taught at Harvard, Yale, Georgetown, having picked up his MPA degree from Princeton about 10 years before I picked up mine. Anecdotally, I recall that the first meeting that we had in Jerusalem, I think Michael was surprised by my prediction that a fairly unknown American senator, Barack Obama, would likely be the next president of the United States. It turned out that he ended up working very, very closely with President Barack Obama. I could go on, but at this point, I will lateral the floor to our wonderful moderator, Larry Mantle, to interview Michael. Larry, as our audience, I think, well knows, has been the host of Air Talk since 1985, the longest running daily talk show in Southern California, and someone we are fortunate and pleased to have as our moderator. Larry, floor is yours.
Thank you, Mel, and Janice and Zev. It's such an honor to be here for this very important series, Israel in Crisis, the briefing number 12 that we're doing today with Ambassador Oren. As you referenced, Janice, we're just a day after the reported 300-some drones and missiles aimed by Iran at Israel. Reports were they were almost all intercepted. And now we, of course, wait for what comes next with a potential Israeli response. Ambassador Oren, thank you so much. We welcome you to America at a Crossroads, Israel in Crisis Briefing 12.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Mel, for that beautiful introduction. Thank you for having such an exquisite memory. Zev and Janice, thank you all for hosting me. Good evening from quiet so far night here in Jaffa in southern Tel Aviv.
We're glad to hear it's
quiet. To start off, Larry, with just a small story that so I think illustrates a good place to start off our conversation tonight. I've been doing a lot of Israeli media. I've just come over off of several interviews. And the question I keep on getting asked, interestingly, by Israeli interviewers is, why does the United States stand by Israel? Why, during the last night's barrage of 350 cruise missiles, attack drones, why do the United States, along with other allied countries, but potentially the United States, why do they feel a need? Why don't they just step aside and, you know, let us within it ourselves? And I recall a the last conversation I had as ambassador with President Obama, which just happened to, by coincidentally, to be my last day in the office at the very end of 2013, I was in the Oval Office. And the president said something I will never forget. It's ingrained in my soul. And he said the following. He says, should Israel ever be attacked by Iranian missiles, the United States will, of course, come to Israel's aid because, again, I quote, that is what the American people expect. And I think that in spite of the differences and sometimes very acute differences we've had over the last 6 months since the outbreak of the Gaza war, since the atrocious and horrific events of October 7th, at the end of the day, the American people still expect American armed forces to stand by Israel in the case of a massive attack by a common enemy, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Thank you for that opening. Let me just interject. We welcome your questions as viewers to our program. If you have something you'd like to ask Ambassador Oren, you can do so. Please include along with your first name, your location. It's just nice for other viewers to know where the question is coming from. You can just put that, of course, in the Q&A, and then we'll be glad to ask as many questions as we can a little bit later in the hour. Ambassador, multiple American news organizations reported a few hours ago, President Biden has privately expressed concern that Prime Minister Netanyahu is trying to drag the U.S. into a broader conflict. They further report Biden told Netanyahu not to retaliate against Iran for the missile and drone launch yesterday, and the U.S. would not participate in offensive operations against Iran. What do you think Israel's likely next move is going to be?
Let me just put this in some type of broader framework, if I could, Larry. There's a popular misconception in the American press, and I think within the United States generally, and that is to view the Prime Minister of Israel as the President of the United States. The President of the United States, of course, is the Commander-in-Chief of all U.S. armed forces. The Prime Minister of Israel is not. The Prime Minister cannot order a war. He can't even order a major operation without going through his war cabinet, and the war cabinet can't do that without getting approval from the broader cabinet. War making and the management of war in Israel is much more of a consensual affair than it is in the United States. So I don't think it'd be Netanyahu trying to drag the United States into a war, if that is even the case, but a decision made by the Israeli government, which this particular government, and I can't speak for this government, I'm not a member of this government, I'm not a civil servant at all at this point, is that this government determines what is in Israel's vital national security interests, it will act accordingly. It'll take into account, of course, the considerations of the United States. It'll take into account the broader picture of what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in the north with Hezbollah. But generally speaking, Larry, what is the president's message to Netanyahu is not unique in the annals of U.S.-Israel history. And I'm talking not just as a practitioner in that history, but as a researcher, as a scholar of that history, going back to 1948, Israel's War of Independence, the Second Arab War, 1956, the Six-Day War in 1967, 82, 91, we can go on through 2006, the Second Lebanon War, and then the four rounds of fighting with Hamas in Gaza. The United States has never given Israel a green light. The United States has never said to Israel, well, if you launch an offensive or a counteroffensive, we're going to join you. That has not been America's policy in the Middle East now, going back, you know, close to 80 years. And it transcends administrations and parties. It's a longstanding policy. Now, sometimes Israel has had to say to the United States, well, we hear you, but we have vital interests at stake. A classic example would be the Six-Day War. Something I've written about, some of you may know, where President Johnson, a great friend of the state of Israel, a Democrat, was adamantly against Israel launching a preemptive strike and was quite disappointed when Israel eventually did. And usually the rule is when Israel stood by its fundamental security interests, even at the risk of defying the United States, in the end of the day, the United States ended up respecting Israel more. And the few times where Israel buckled to that pressure, 1973 war is a good example, Golda Meir, we earned less than respect.
Well, let's talk, though, about what is strategically in Israel's best interest at this point, because as in Washington Post op-ed this morning from Max Boot. He writes that Israel is certainly morally in the clear to respond to Iran's attack of a sovereign nation by a sovereign nation, but that it would strategically be a mistake to do so because of the escalation it would bring, that Iran clearly in its actions did what was intended for its missiles and for the drones to be intercepted. This was not intended to inflict significant damage on Israel. So Boot's argument is best to let this go, that you gain by not retaliating. What do you think?
Well, I applaud the perspicacity of my friend Max Boot in penetrating the inner thinking of the Iranian leadership. When you fire 350 missiles and drones at Israel, you cannot assume that some aren't going to get through. And our best experts are saying tonight that the Iranians were quite surprised that none got through. All you needed was one of these cruise missiles to come in, say, from my neighborhood. And these are missiles that don't take down a building. They take down a neighborhood. You could have thousands of Israelis killed this morning. It was, I won't say it's a stroke of luck, but we certainly beat out the odds with great technologies, including technologies that we developed with the United States. I thoroughly reject Max's position. I think it's based on pure, I think, flight of imagination, frankly. We got quite lucky last night, and the situation could be very, very different. The issue here is not, you know, is not what is strategically smart, not smart. It's about how you survive in this neighborhood. And you survive in this neighborhood by convincing the other side that attacking us the way Iran attacked us last night is really not a good idea. And again, historically speaking, it has been the failure to meet escalation with escalation that has led to greater escalation in the Middle East. Let's go back to the Six-Day War. Forgive me for being the historian. It was Nasser who closed the Straits of Tehran, Nasser who kicked the UN out of Sinai, and no one reacted. So Nasser just kept on escalating higher and higher until it precipitated a war. I can think of many other examples like that.
But let's step back in this instance.
Please. I lost you, Larry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was gesticulating and hit my mute. There's so much to cover. I just want to get through as many of these topics as possible. But please. The Iran's launch yesterday, wasn't that in response to the reported attack by Israel on April 1st on the Damascus compound where the Iranian general was killed? This in response, Israel is attempting to punish for the proxy attacks coming from Hezbollah in the north against Israel, where the evacuations have. So if there isn't a point where you say, okay, we're going to step back from this one, how does that avoid constant escalation?
Again, I got to go back in context. This is not about what happened in Damascus about a week ago, what happened last night. The United States and Israel and Iran have been at war for well over three decades. You can go back to the destruction of Israeli embassies and the bombing of Jewish communities in Argentina. How far you want back, you want to go. And to pinpoint, you know, cherry pick two different events and say, you know, Israel did this, so Iran had to do this, is simply ignoring a context of a three decade plus long war between Israel and Iran. And that is a war which is certainly in recent years, we have played according to Iran's rules. And it's not just Israel, but the United States has played according to those rules. And what are the rules, Larry? Well, very simple. Iran sends its proxies to shoot at us or to shoot at American troops in Iraq and Syria and Jordan, or shoot at ships going through the Mandab Straits off of Yemen. And Israel and the United States respond by shooting back at the proxies, not at the country that sent and armed the proxies. And from our perspective, it's a bad game because the proxies then hide behind the civilian population. Large numbers of civilians get killed and we get branded as war criminals in every single round, going from the second Lebanon war through the four rounds of fighting with Hamas. And every single time Iran pays zero price, comes out completely unscathed. And my hope from last night is that Iran will now internalize that it is no longer immune in playing this game, but the rules of the game have been changed.
Is that Iran is the stronger military power without the United States standing side by side with Israel. So how does Israel gain by responding in kind to Iran for what happened yesterday, when it ultimately, with continuing escalation, isn't going to win that fight?
Let's see, about 100% reject that assertion. I don't know where you're getting these figures from. Iran, to the best of my knowledge, has no air force. Iran, to my best of my knowledge, has no tank formations. Iran, from my information, has no army the size of the IDF, which is more than twice as large as the British and French armies combined in absolute numbers. Iran cannot call up, as Israel did during this last war in Gaza, 360,000 reservists, which would be the equivalent of about 20 million Americans. That's more Americans than fought in World War II. There is actually, Iran is a serious threat to the state of Israel. It is a strategic threat to the state of Israel. Hezbollah, too, is a strategic threat to the state of Israel. But Israel can defend itself. It can defend itself much better with the United States at its side. We can pay a much lower price for defending ourselves with Iran by its side. But make no mistake about it, Larry, in any way, Israel is the superior military force in the Middle East, period.
Even without the U.S. to constantly supply it with weapons and funding to carry out wars, if the U.S. decided to sit on the sidelines, you think Iran, with less than a tenth the population of Iran, would be victorious?
Israel would have a harder time. It does not an impossible time. Again, history. We fought the Six-Day War without a single American bullet. It seems we did pretty well in that war. So it made it very harder. And I don't think America's going to sit on the sidelines for the reason I talked about with, say, what President Obama told me in my last day of office, but also because America's military support for Israel is first and foremost an American strategic interest. Not only does the aid which Israel received from the United States is a subsidy for the American arms industry and provides tens of thousands of jobs, but it also provides the United States military with a testing ground for many of its technologies, and also a very good publicity platform. You know, Israel is the first air force in the world to use the F-35 jet as its fundamental aircraft. That aircraft is now the most combat experienced aircraft in the world. That's very good news for the people of Fort Worth, Texas, where that aircraft is made. So I don't see America cutting off that aid.
Okay. So if Hezbollah, Iran, the Houthis with their attacks on waterways, and of course whatever Hamas has in its forces still in beleaguered Gaza, if Israel had to fight all those different fronts simultaneously, you think it could still hold out?
Oh, sure it could. I have no doubt about it, but at a great price. You're talking about the strongest and most resilient society in the world. You should see Israel today, a day after this massive attack last night. All the streets were out, people are out. Even Friday, if you came to I live near the Jaffa market, the Shuk, people are dancing in the street. Who does that during wartime? We are a very, very resilient society. And yes, we would prevail, but at a tremendous price. And the price would be lessened by cooperation with the United States, with the support of the United States. And for that, we have to be very, very grateful.
What's happening behind the scenes in this whole war with Gaza, with Egypt, with Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia? So to what extent are they players here, and what sort of involvement do they have either in talking with Americans or having their interest funneled through to consideration in Israel's leadership?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and it's a sort of a multifaceted question, because each of the countries you mentioned have a different dynamic, different relations with us. One of the truly serendipitous, if you can even use that word, outcomes of last night was that the Jordanians and reportedly even the Saudis were involved in interdicting these missiles that were fired at us. The Jordanian foreign minister came out and made a statement about it today and took pride in the fact that Jordan had taken down a number of these missiles. He said it wasn't for Israel we did it. We did it to guard our airspace against an enemy that was trying to use that airspace to launch an attack. Very good. It's interesting that the Iranian propaganda ministry printed a picture of King Abdullah today wearing an Israeli military uniform. They downgraded him to colonel only three falafels instead of, you know, four. But so the Jordanians have an interest. Jordanians, you know, the Jordanian people are highly, highly critical of Israel, but the Jordanian government and the people that the Jordanian government, that part of Jordanian society that's represented by that government, have a fundamental interest in their historic alliance with Israel, and it goes very far back. Egyptians also have a fundamental interest in their strategic alliance with the state of Israel. Again, it's not a warm peace, it's a cold peace, and the peace between governments and not between peoples. But other countries in the region, like the UAE, like Bahrain, have not only a peace and a strategic interest, they also have a very warm peace. And it's interesting, during the Gaza war, there was only two airlines that really kept flying in and out of Ben Gurion Airport. That was El Al and UAE Airlines. Other everyone else canceled their flights. So it's different. Qatar, I think, is the real, how should I say this, the odd man out. Qatar, in many ways, vies with Iran to be the world's largest sponsor of terror. It engages in this war in many, many ways. And yet we have a hard time sort of turning our back on Qatar, because we want to use the Qatari influence on Hamas to perhaps reach a deal for the release of hostages. It's difficult. America's relationship with Qatar is also very complicated, because the U.S. Air Force has a very large base there. There are American universities that have branches in Qatar. And Qatar has a lot of investment, as we now know, in American universities in return. So it's a complex relationship. I mean, I perfectly would like to see some reckoning with Qatar when the war in Gaza is concluded, that Qatar be put on unequivocal notice that continued support for terror is not acceptable to the United States in the West, and it must end.
Ambassador, Friday and yesterday, groups of West Bank settlers attacked Palestinian communities, ostensibly in a search for a missing 14-year-old boy. Cars and homes were burned, dozens of people injured. There was a report of one Palestinian resident killed. The IDF says the teen's body was later found and that he was a victim of what they called a terrorist attack. How concerned should we be that the West Bank will devolve into ongoing and worsening violence?
We should be concerned. And there's no excuse for settler violence. There's no excuse for the murder of a 14-year-old Jewish shepherd, as which he was. No excuse. And it's a situation that we have to be extremely cautious in handling, vigilant, and sensitive all at once. You know, you mentioned before about the possibility of multi-front wars. They are very real, those possibilities. We certainly don't need another one. So far, the West Bank Palestinians have disappointed Hamas. Hamas expected the Palestinians of the West Bank to rise up in revolt. They have not. That is a good sign. And I hope that that is a trend that Israel can harness to achieve some type of progress in our relationship with the Palestinians.
I raise the next question, not in any way at all, to justify or sanitize the killings, assaults, atrocities, and kidnappings that were carried out by Hamas on October 7th. And I would doubt that anyone's watching, despite what can be very intense criticism on these programs of Israel's policies, that anybody would give a moral pass or defense for Hamas's actions. But however, to what extent has Netanyahu's administration exacerbated conflict with Hamas and harmed Israel's reputation by allowing dramatic expansion of West Bank settlements, East Jerusalem settlements, and neighborhoods?
That's an interesting question. I know you're going to go in that direction, but let's take it step. Let's take the notion of settlements first of all, because it's a generalization. There are upwards of a half a million Israelis who live across from what much of the world calls the 1967 lines in Jerusalem. The majority of Jews in Jerusalem live beyond those lines. My own kids grew up within about 20 yards of those lines. They didn't even know they existed. Didn't even know that the people down the block were being called settlers by the rest of the world. But there are outlying settlements, which are beyond the blocks. The blocks count about 85% of those settlements. And those settlements were created in the aftermath of the 1967 war to thicken out Israel's borders, which even the United States at the time deemed undefensible, because Israel was only 8 miles wide at the time. And several times Arab armies had tried to cut us in half at that very narrow weight line. So there was a strategic aspect to it. There is, of course, a religious aspect to it, and we can't deny it. I'm sitting in Jaffa, and my claim to Jaffa is exactly the same claim as someone who's sitting out in a settlement in Judea and Samaria, as we call it, and that is that this land is our ancestral homeland. But the fact of the matter is the person out in the West Bank has a much better claim because Tel Aviv doesn't appear in the Bible and Haifa doesn't appear in the Bible, but Bethlehem and Hebron and Bethel and Shiloh, of course, do appear in the Bible. And so a Jewish state so constituted has a very hard time telling Jews they can't live in their homeland. But having settled that, it's one thing to be right, and it's another thing to be smart. And building settlements, certainly illegal settlements or unauthorized settlements is probably a better word, in areas that could be part of some future Palestinian autonomy is not smart, especially if it causes frictions between us and the United States at a time of war when we need the closest possible relationships with the United States as well as with our remaining friends in the Western world.
What is gained by the Israeli government's position of not being willing to talk about a two-state solution and a Palestinian state? Because we so often hear the rhetoric coming from Israeli leaders, well, the Palestinians themselves don't accept a two-state when there have been opportunities to come to agreement on it. They have, even up to the last minute, turned away from that opportunity. So if that's really the view, that Palestinians, the majority, don't want a two-state solution, then looking at this just even from a self-interested standpoint, why wouldn't it make sense for the Israeli government to say consistently, we believe in a two-state solution with an Israeli with a Palestinian self-determined state alongside Israel, and to hold that to that position on an ongoing basis? Because if there really is the view Palestinians won't accept it, then there's nothing lost by taking that as the moral position of Israel, is there?
Oh, it's an interesting question. It actually was Israel's position during the entire time I was in Washington. And I was very comfortable with that position. You may remember that Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a speech in 2009 at Bar Ilan University. That was precisely. The last round of talks with the Palestinians, and that's already quite a long time ago, our last round of negotiations, I came away with some very fundamental conclusions. Yes, there is obviously no proof I can adduce over the last almost 100 years that the Palestinians actually want a state. They actually hold the record, the world's record of a people who've been offered a state and have turned it down, and turned it down often with violence in 1937, 1947. Certainly in 2000 and 2001. And I haven't been able to adduce a lot of evidence that the Palestinians are actually thinking about what kind of state they want and whether they'd actually be willing to live side by side with a legitimate, recognized Jewish state. And I haven't been able to find a Palestinian leader who's ever willing to say that, or they're going to give up what they call the right of return of refugees. There are many, many, many obstacles. Having said all that, saying, as you suggest, to the world, hey, we're open to suggestions, we're open to talking, to my mind, costs us nothing. And it actually gives our armed forces time and space to achieve what they need to achieve in the battle against Hamas and perhaps against Hezbollah. I'm all about the time and space to assure our security. So while I can make many, many arguments against that sort of two-state solution, and I think it's kind of an oxymoron, that doesn't mean Israel shouldn't talk about it. And that's why during my period in Washington, it was relatively easy for me because that was our position.
We have a number of viewer questions I'm going to get to momentarily and take more of those, I think, than we typically do. So many excellent ones are coming in, and I thank you for those. 3 weeks ago, former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was with us. He claimed Hamas forces were degraded enough that Israel didn't need to go into Rafah and that a lasting ceasefire should be negotiated for the immediate release of the Israeli hostages. He further stated Israel is rapidly losing international support and that going into Rafah would cost the country more than and create more loss of Israeli lives and hurt the international reputation of the country more than would be benefited with what he saw as an insignificant number of Hamas fighters in Rafah. What do you think?
I think the former prime minister is representing a position which is held by a very small minority of Israelis. A significant majority of Israelis understand that we have to continue the fight against Hamas. Or as Benny Gantz, minister, said the other day, you can't put out a forest fire by putting out 80% of the fire. So it's not just people in Netanyahu and his right-wing government. It's also people in important leaders of the opposition who say that we have to continue the battle. And Olmert's right in the sense that this is going to cost us precipitously in terms of our foreign relations, our relationship with the United States, in terms of human lives, both on our side and on the Palestinian side. And yet Israel has no choice. It has no choice, because if we were to agree to what Olmert suggests, that we basically announce that we've lost the war, we pull out of Gaza, we let Hamas take over the rest of the Gaza Strip once again to rearm and remount the next strike against Israel. And this is what their leaders say openly. They say, we'll do it a million times until Israel's destroyed. Then we have accomplished nothing. And by the way, we won't get back. We won't get back all the hostages, because already Hamas has said Hamas says they don't know where they are. Hamas will keep many of those hostages for what they would think is a rainy day. And then Israelis will not be able to go back to their homes along the borders. People will lose faith in this government. The soldiers, the hundreds of thousands of soldiers who have fought and served for months and months, will say, what did we fight and die for? What did our friends suffer for?
In fairness to Olmert, I don't think he was saying, I don't think he was saying, Ambassador, that Israel should admit defeat. I think his view is that Israel should declare victory, and that the numbers of Hamas fighters in Rafah were not significant enough to reconstitute a Hamas government. So what he was saying is that there can be international parties that come in for a temporary period, govern Gaza during the course of its rebuilding, and that that would keep Hamas from reforming itself and taking over the government.
Yeah, a similar plan worked terrifically in the arrangement that Olmert made with the UN in southern Lebanon after the second Lebanon war, and we see what happens with Lebanon. Lebanon is now taken over fully by Hezbollah and Iran. I wouldn't take his advice too seriously. Go with the gut feeling of the majority of Israelis, and that we understand the very steep costs which such an operation will entail, and that ultimately we have no choice. And
since you support,
it will be good for the Palestinians as well.
Since you support Israel going into Rafah and going after the remaining Hamas fighters there, what strategy would you employ, and how would you protect the civilian population there?
Well, I've come up with various programs, and they, by the way, here, I can't say I stand on majority ground. I have suggested that Israel actually create a major displaced person camp within our territory in the Gaza Strip. It'd be great if they could do it in Egypt. Egyptians won't let them. But in such an area, we could move these Palestinians out of harm's way and provide the necessary material, food, and medical help that they would need, and then move them back once the fighting had concluded, or we accelerate the process through which displaced Palestinians can return to their homes in the center and northern part of the country. None of these solutions are foolproof. They're not, with many of their detractors on all sides, right and left. One of the great fears about creating that type of enclave within the Negev desert has been the fear that people on the right will say, well, they won't go back, and we will have imported a million Palestinians into our population. There's no foolproof method. This is I can't stress this enough. Looking historically again, forgive me, I don't know any state that's ever faced these type of dilemmas, these type of decisions. I don't know any state that's ever faced these type of military challenges and humanitarian challenges. There's just almost no precedent for it in modern history. At the end of the day, Israel acts out of a sense of what we need to survive. And I think the very solid majority of Israelis understand that going into Rafah is a matter of national survival.
Ambassador, I think it's fair to say that there are many Jewish Americans who are highly critical of Netanyahu's government, believe that it actually harms Israel's interest and endangers its survival, along with external attacks against the country. We had, of course, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, call for a new election to replace Netanyahu. We've had a number of prominent Jewish Americans who've written pieces about the need for Netanyahu to go. There's been some criticism of Schumer as the highest ranking Jewish American that, you know, he shouldn't say that in the middle of the war in Gaza. What's your opinion about political activism on the part of Jewish and other Americans against the Netanyahu government?
I think any type of political expression that comes within the context of support for Israel's right to defend itself and Israel's right to exist as a sovereign Jewish state in our homeland, that criticism is fair. And fair game. And American Jews have every right to voice it. And I do think, though, that people like Chuck Schumer should show a greater respect for Israel's democracy. It has nothing to do with my feelings about Netanyahu and Netanyahu's government. I think parts of that government are just indefensible, and I won't defend it, as you'll see. But I still have deep, deep respect for Israel's democracy. One of the few countries in the world that has never known a second of non-democratic governance. The United States is on that list, but there aren't many other countries. But we're the only country on that list that's never known a second of peace. And any attempt at that level to interfere in our democracy or to draw a distinction between the people of Israel and the government of Israel that those people elected, I think is conduct unbecoming for an ally, certainly for a democratic ally.
Now, the flip side of that could be argued, though, that what he was really doing was giving voice through his prominent platform to what millions of American Jews feel about Netanyahu's leadership and the dismay that they have over it. So, you know, his argument would probably be that he's representing not just his immediate constituents, but many Jewish Americans here in the U.S.
Or you can make the flip side of the flip side, which is he wasn't representing the millions of American Jews who happen to like Netanyahu. I've just finished several trips across the United States. I visited, I think, upwards of 40 different communities in the United States, and they're very divided over their opinions about Netanyahu. Depends where you go and what kind of synagogue you're attending. I think you'll understand that. And so he wasn't voicing, you know, for all American Jews. He was voicing for some, maybe many. I don't have statistic evidence to prove that he was speaking for the majority or what the extent of that majority might even be. What I care about is respecting Israeli democracy. And right now, we are witnessing a period where the only place where the United States was really calling for regime change, certainly in the Middle East, was in the state of Israel.
Let's get to some excellent viewer questions. The first comes from Michael, who asks, why have Israeli efforts to make their case publicly been so ineffective, not just currently, but in recent decades?
I do not mean to disparage this question in any way, but it is literally the most frequently asked question I get and have received now for many decades. It's not just during this period. Why is Israeli PR so bad? And if I had an hour and a half, I could probably go into it. It extends everything from a certain amount of insularity in the part of Israelis. It was Ben-Gurion who said rather infamously, it's not important what the non-Jews think, it's what the Jews do. And that notion is very deeply ingrained in this country, especially among young Israelis, you'd be surprised to hear, who say, listen, they're going to condemn us for war crimes no matter what we do. We can know why spend, you know, interest, why spend precious resources in trying to defend ourselves? It's not going to do any good. That's a difficulty I encounter all the time with young Israelis. But having been in this field for many years of diplomacy and public diplomacy, I've reached a rather a difficult conclusion, and that is that we are the Jewish state. And as the Jewish state, we are going to be judged by a completely different set of criteria, certainly even different criteria than the United States of America. Even the statistics that relate to the ratio between combatants and non-combatant deaths in Gaza. The U.S., the Israeli figures are about anywhere from a quarter to almost one to what a quarter or almost twice that many of the ratio of combatant to non-combatant deaths that the United States inflicted in its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're judged completely, completely different. And behind many of the anti-Israel headlines or the critical headlines of Israel, you'll see classic anti-Semitic tropes, the massacre of the innocents, the blood libel. Statistically, the Hamas figures about the number of women and children killed in Gaza are actually statistically impossible. I'll call your attention to a wonderful article by a University of Pennsylvania professor named Abraham Weiner that shows mathematically why they're statistically impossible. But the myth is that Israel is going to go out and kill children. And that's a classic anti-Semitic trope. I accept.
Well, and you're not denying the fact that there have been scores of civilians, including children, who have been killed in the Israeli military action in Gaza. You're not denying that.
Larry, Palestinian civilian death is a tragedy. Every civilian Palestinian death is one death too many. But we are fighting in a war where we're dealing with an enemy who's not only using that population as a human shield that wants them to die, because that's the only way you're going to get international pressure on Israel to get to a ceasefire, which Hamas wants, because the ceasefire means Hamas wins. But we're using with the enemy that's just using Gaza itself as a shield with 450 miles of tunnels between the very small swath of territory in Gaza. So it's an impossible, almost nearly impossible situation for any army to encounter, especially where, you know, there's very few places for the civilian populations to evacuate to.
But this speaks to the challenge of Israel's messaging, Ambassador, because here you have a case where Hamas has embedded itself a layer beneath the civilian population, using that population as a shield. And Hamas, of course, could bring things to a close with a surrender, release of the hostages, and stepping fully out of power. But that's not what's in the public conversation. That's not that that Hamas is not held responsible in any way for that among much of the public conversation. So how does that happen? And how is Israel unable to make that point?
And I don't really have a good defense against that, Larry. I tell you honestly, it's the source of great frustration for me, even pain for me. We haven't established a national authority for making our case to the world. I've just come back from a summit of American Jewish leaders in Washington, and one of their principal complaints was that they don't get information for us. So, for example, a very typical claim is that Israel bombs indiscriminately in Gaza. Nothing can be further from the truth. Every Israeli bombing action goes through a very lengthy approving process that includes by legal experts. Mistakes happen in war. I've been in several. Believe me, I've seen enough Israelis bombed by Israeli jets, not just enemy or Palestinian or Lebanese civilians, Israelis. Mistakes happen. But it is not indiscriminate bombing. But people who support us in the United States, certainly within the American Jewish community, don't know that. They don't know about that process. So we have been derelict in a very severe way in not making our case. And I cannot defend and will not defend our failure to make that case.
And I just say this as an aside. You've written extensively, and I've been reading your work on genocide and how, in a sense, that's encroached on the singularity of the Holocaust. And so the suffering of many other people has been much talked about and documented. And you make the point, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the real defenses of Israel's need and right to survive is what the Holocaust represented in its severity as a one-of-a-kind event requiring a safe place for Jews from around the world to be able to go who are displaced or under threat. And that, as important as it is to talk about other genocides of other groups, that's sort of the Holocaust's singularity in the massive scale and horrific event, that has in a sense been lost, and therefore a reason for Israel's existence is lost.
Well, it's not a reason for Israel's existence. It is part of our strategic planning, put it that way. That was the essence of the article. I didn't say that people cannot talk about other genocides.
Right.
And
right.
The uniqueness of the genocide, I believe the Holocaust was unique, but I didn't talk about that in the article. What I talked about was the fact that if we are going to get war and defending ourselves against an enemy that wants to annihilate us, and understand that a war of national annihilations are very, very rare in history. You know, the United States went to war against Germany and Japan, World War II, not to destroy Germany and Japan. just to change their government. So we've now faced successive attempts to annihilate us by various enemies. That the fact that the Jewish people have established this state a mere 3 years after the end of an attempt to annihilate us in Europe is a very important part of our national defense strategy. And I make the case that along with, you know, the great airplanes and the great tanks, the fact that we have the Holocaust to fall back on and refer to is an important part of our defense thinking. And I also mentioned the fact that I had refused to meet with certain right-wing when I was in government as defense, as deputy minister in the prime minister's office, and I was in charge of diplomacy. Even in that position, I refused to meet with several far-right ministers and leaders from Europe because they had roots either in Nazi parties or in fascist parties, but had been involved in denying the Holocaust. And I thought that these people could be very pro-Israel. They can stand by us. They can even break the European Union's unanimity against us. But at the end of the day, we should not sell our birthright of the Holocaust cheaply, because we're going to have to call on that legacy when we go to war against genocidal enemies.
We have many viewers who have commented that while you say it's important to respect Israel's democracy and call on the world to do that, but for a number of our viewers have said they don't think Netanyahu respects Israel's democracy. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, certainly there was a huge controversy for the year leading up to this conflict. And that controversy was really over the nature of Israel's democracy. It was a fight over democracy. Now, maybe be clear, I've often thought, and again, it's in this book, the 2048 book, a chapter on the need for judicial reform. And there is a need for judicial reform in Israel. It's not uncommon in democracies to sort of check and tweak and make things right and get the balance right. But the government's position was basically to neuter the Supreme Court to the point where, you know, why even bother having a Supreme Court? And I'm a person who regards the principle of judicial review as one of the great pillars of democracy. And that was what being threatened by the government's policy. And so I opposed the policy. And we haven't heard much about it since. I don't think it's going to come back very quickly or certainly in the same form. So you can say this was a victory for Israeli democracy. Having said that, I do hope there'll be some reform that will really adjust the balance between our legislative, our executive, and our judicial branches.
Dorit asks, what is the role and what are the limits on the power of Israel's prime minister? How is it different than the limits and the power of the president?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to answer it in a truly Israeli Jewish way by asking another question. The question is, who is the commander-in-chief of the Israeli armed forces? Is it the prime minister? Is it the defense minister? Is it the chief of staff? Really, who runs this thing? And the answer is, it's the Israeli government. And the Israeli government, it has a kitchen cabinet, a war cabinet made up of a select group of ministers, many of whom have a military background. But they also have to, for major decisions like going to war, they have to get the approval of the broader government, which has now well over 30 ministers in it. And so going to war in Israel or making any major move, even going to peace with Israel, is much more of a consensual process than it is in the United States. And it reflects our society, the society where the difference between the civilian and military sectors is almost non-existent, where we all know people in the military, and you have to, if you're in the government and you want to make a decision to go to war, you got to convince people to say, you're going to send your children, your brothers, your parents off to war. That government has to have a tremendous amount of legitimacy. And one of my great fears in the immediate aftermath of October 7th was that the current government had a deep legitimacy deficit going into October 7th. On October 7th, the little legitimacy it had was lost. And now we've been operating on sort of legitimacy overdraft or deficit in the post-October 7th period. One last line about this, which is interesting, is that in Israeli code, when you have someone like the chief of staff, the defense minister, the head of the Mossad, the head of the Shabak, our internal security, come out and say, I take responsibility. That's Israeli code for I screwed up. I'm going to make it right. And as soon as I make it right, I'm going to resign. There's only one person who hasn't said those three words. I take responsibility.
And that one person is?
Benjamin Netanyahu. And it is really, society is very forgiving of that, by the way. No one has called for the resignation of the chief of staff or the head of the Mossad or the head of Shabak. Everybody is willing to give them that redemptive chance. We're a very redemptive society. And as we're coming up to Passover, I'll tell you, it's the holiday of redemption. We're a redemptive society. We're willing to give people a second chance, but we will expect them, once the war is concluded, to resign.
Ramon in Altadena asks, doesn't Iran have significant cyber capabilities to make up for what you've said is their lack of physical military capacity with cyber warfare?
They do, but Israel is number two or three most advanced cyber defense country in the world. We are 0.002% of the world's population, but we make up about 25% of the world's investment in cyber defense. We have an entire cyber defense campus. So yes, Iran does have capabilities, but what can I say? So do we. And I'm willing to bet that our capabilities are in advance of those of Iran.
Larry asks, shouldn't Israel acknowledge and appreciate the solid participation of the UK and French air forces in the defense of Israel?
Definitely. I don't know why we wouldn't. Of course we do. And I've acknowledged it myself publicly in all of my press interviews.
Joel in Toronto says, it was said yesterday was the most expensive in Israel's history. The Arrow 3 anti-missile missiles were jointly developed by Boeing and Israel, cost $2.5 to $3 million each. Who pays for this enormous expense?
Well, I think that the price falls on both countries. It falls on us because we actually buy them, and then we use American aid to buy the rest. Each interceptor of David Sling, which is the intermediate level anti-missile defense system that was developed jointly by the United States and Israel, each of those interceptors cost about $1 million. And I've heard, I don't have, you know, I can't, you know, give a footnote to this, that all of the Iranian hardware fired at us last night, you know, came to several million dollars worth. Whereas for Israel, it costs roughly $1 billion.
Let's see, we have Sarah in Santa Monica. Is the Gaza war, the humanitarian crisis there, is it fundamentally changing the American people's supportive relationship with Israel?
And the answer to that is yes and no. I think for a certain segment of the American population, it has profoundly changed that perception. And yet, if you look at the most recent poll by Harvard, says that support for Israel in this war remains very, very high. In recent weeks, it's been as high as 82%. So it depends which Americans you're looking at. If you're looking at Americans, I think, who come from, say, urban areas, who are young, who are college educated, I think that 82% goes far, far down. And if you look at, these are the same people who are occupying many government positions, who are prominent in the media. And so that is an image going across. Again, if you were to boil down the statistics, and again, I have to stress, every Palestinian casualty is a tragedy and one too many. Hamas puts out these figures, and they have been proven to be fabricated. But let's just say, for argument's sake, that Israel, that 32,000 Palestinians have been killed. Of the 32,000, 14,000 are terrorists. So that takes it down much less. Thousands of Palestinians have been killed by the 30% of Palestinian rockets that fall short and fall in Gaza. And on top of everybody else, just by natural causes, over a six-month period, about 4,000 Palestinians, civilians in Gaza, would die. And so you're now down to that one-to-one combatant to civilian fatality ratio, whereas when the United States was fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was between 1 in 4 and 1 in 9 civilians killed for every combatant killed. So Israel, you know, in the annals of modern warfare, is establishing a new record, if you will, a new level of way to carry it. But still, I understand.
We're tight on time, but I just have to say the criticism of Israel, I think, is as much about the inability of humanitarian aid to getting in, with people starving, the lack of water, the lack of Israel being able to help facilitate humanitarian aid for the people suffering. I think that's as much the criticism, concerns about people directly killed by air assault.
It is indeed. It is indeed. And I can't, again, I'm not a spokesman for the government, and I have my own positions. Sometimes they're very controversial. They were controversial even tonight in my interviews. At the very beginning of the war, I think I stressed that Israel has to do everything possible to avert a humanitarian disaster in Gaza. There was a moral component to my position, but also a strategic component. Remember, Hamas wants one thing and one thing only. It's a ceasefire. How do you get a ceasefire? International pressure on Israel. How do you get international pressure on Israel? A lot of people, a lot of Palestinians die. Simple as that. Hamas has an interest in Palestinian mortality. And by denying aid, and many Israelis wanted to deny aid, including many members of my own family who I would say are probably left of center, felt that giving aid to Palestinians is actually giving aid to Hamas. Hamas is going to take that aid. It's going to sell that aid. And Hamas wouldn't even give us the names of the hostages, wouldn't even let the Red Cross visit the hostages. No medicines reached the hostages. This was the only leverage many Israelis believed that we had over Hamas. With the hostages, I think it was a faulty reasoning, because Hamas actually wanted the humanitarian aid, and by denying aid, we were helping Hamas. You got to wrap your head around. This is a different world. So I have come out as recently as tonight and saying we've got to flood Gaza with aid, not just give it, flood it. Everyone should have plenty of aid, even at the risk of feeding Hamas. And it is a controversial position in Israel even today.
We're almost out of time. Real quickly, this one, though, it's a very important question from Diana in Los Angeles, and others ask it as well. What would it take to reduce Hamas to not be a threat to repeat an October 7th-like attack? How would you define success in the war on Hamas?
Excellent question. And it's this. We can defeat Hamas militarily. We can dismantle and destroy its remaining battalions. We can inhibit it from ever getting control over Gaza again. We can eliminate its leadership. But let's be clear about this. We can't defeat Hamas as an idea. The idea of Hamas is almost indistinguishable from that of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a jihadist group that seeks to transform the entire Middle East and eventually the entire world into an Islamic state. Hamas just wants to destroy Israel in the first stage of that ultimately global effort. We can't do that. And that's going to require continued vigilance on the part of Israel, but not just Israel, countries throughout the entire Middle East. So our tactical goals are certainly achievable. I do think they're achievable at a price. And I will not in any way minimize that price, neither to us nor to the Palestinians. Ultimately, though, if you cannot speak about the possibility of any progress toward peace unless Hamas is eliminated. Again, I go back to my own experience as an advisor to multiple Israeli governments. Every time we made any progress toward peace, Hamas came out and killed. It killed Israelis, but it also killed Palestinians, killed hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians. And so you want those people who really care about peace are going to have to give this war a chance. Forgive me, John Lennon. Going to have to give it a chance, as difficult and painful as that is, because the way to future progress can only be through the elimination of Hamas as a serious governing and military force.
Ambassador, just in closing, we have about 30 seconds because we're up against the end time, but I'd like to ask you if there's anything that you see in this period of so much tragedy and loss and a threat to Israel, anything hopeful that you see in the developments of the past week or so?
All of my experience, you know, whether it be academic or political or diplomatic, points to the fact that every horrible, terrible crisis has almost the opposite of extraordinary opportunities. We have immense opportunities. I just mentioned an opportunity now by eliminating Hamas will open the way to the possibility of progress with the Palestinians. We have an opportunity to stop Iran, to deter Iran, and to enable the Middle East to engage in a path, embark on a path to regional peace, hopefully under the aegis of the United States, sort of a Pax Americana redux. We see an Israeli society, which has proven to be the most resilient and strongest on the planet, in which people leave their homes, leave their families to go out and fight for what they believe in, and they know they may not come home. And how many countries in the world can that happen today?
Thank
I can
you.
Count on very, very few. So on that, there is, for me, I'm an optimistic person, there's hope.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Oren. We really appreciate you talking with us today, and especially going with us on such a wide sweep of topics during this hour-long conversation. We appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Have a peaceful night.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Oren, with us. Please support these programs where these kinds of very high-profile, expert, and influential guests come together sometimes twice a week on these programs, as is the case this week, to share about what's happening right now, the very latest details. This is another example in the past 24 hours, incredible events happening in Israel, and we have one of the foremost experts in the world. We're able to bring you, because of the work of Janice, Zev, and Mel in putting these great speakers together with us as viewers. Please make your tax-deductible contribution by going to the website JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org. That's JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org. You can make your contribution, which goes right into presenting these programs that are free and available around the world.